And one of the problems for me was simply that, like, I would find myself with somebody and there was this enormous pressure I felt in that moment to play a particular role, to be feminine, to play an expected part in this whole kind of dynamic. And I found that, like, really, really hard, to the point where I would kind of dissociate. I would be too stressed about how I had to create this illusion for this other person so that I wouldn't be rejected.
James McDonald promised to meet me for an interview, so one day we met. What you're about to hear now is a talk with this humoristic and outgoing stand-up comedian who is also trans. My name is Camilla Telestam, and this is a part of a pod series called Rainbow People.
My hometown is London, Ontario, which some Europeans seem to think is funny and quaint. But it's a real London. It's a real London, Ontario. And we have a river going through London, Ontario, which is called the Thames. Because that's just how much imagination people have where I am from.
Can you tell me a little bit about your background in Canada?
I grew up in London, Ontario, and went to school in Toronto. And after that, I had a degree in English and theater and biology. And I thought, what am I going to do with this? My mom said, why don't you go to Finland for 1 year? And that was 16 years ago. So either I forgot how to count or, I don't know, I got stuck, something. Yeah, I just never left. I came here and I just haven't left yet. I mean, I was 24 and I wasn't quite sure what I was going to be doing with my life. And she said, you know, you don't have to jump into whatever career right away. I mean, I was trained in theater, but I was also really shy and I hated networking and I hated self-promotion. And I thought, like, I didn't know how I was going to break into the art scene in Canada. I had no confidence in this myself whatsoever. I didn't tell her that, but that's that's what I felt.
Could you tell me about your childhood?
I think I had a great childhood, apparently. We didn't have a ton of money when I was growing up, so I was always like at school with kids who were more wealthy than I was, and they always had the more fashionable clothes and the more kind of what's going on. I think my first week of grade one, I wrote a letter to the teacher at the end of the first week of grade one saying, please, can I have some more work? I'm bored. And I was doing really well in school, but also I loved to do all of that stuff. And for me, like sitting in a classroom where people got to tell me to do things and then I would do them, for me was just amazing. A lot of kids have trouble with authority or they didn't like it or something, but I loved that kind of, I don't know, something about that environment made me very secure and happy. So I enjoyed school pretty much all the way through school.
How did the process of finding out your gender identity go?
I think the process kind of happened. I mean, it didn't happen in a vacuum at all. Because if things had stayed in society the same way that they had been when I was a kid, then maybe I wouldn't have thought anything about it at all. Two things that sort of happened was that over time, over many, many years, my dissatisfaction with my gender presentation, with presenting as a woman and trying to live the life of a woman, my dissatisfaction with that just kind of kept piling on. It wasn't resolving. It was a problem that it wasn't getting better. It was constantly getting a little bit worse. And then the other thing that happened at the same time was that the visibility of the technologies that we could use to change people, and like the medical technologies, and also the visibility for me of people who had used those and how they were, that was really influential as well. Like, it was really important for me to see other people who had transitioned who then were happy, or happier than they were before, or satisfied with this particular aspect of themselves. And seeing that was extremely influential and really, really important. Without having seen those other people, I don't think I would have taken it upon myself to transition. But at the same time, it was something that was kind of in the back of my mind all the time, since I was a little kid.
At that time, were you happy?
I think I was mostly frustrated, maybe, because I had a really clear knowledge of how you're supposed to behave as a woman and what you're supposed to look like as a woman. And I know that those things are kind of like, those are superficial. That's not the whole thing of it. But I also knew that I had a particular way of presenting myself that made me feel like I was me. And I would go through these periods where I would grow my hair out long and I would wear skirts and I would think like, okay, I need to attract. I want to attract men, and I want to signal that I am that I'm in that game. You know, I want to try and grow up and be a proper woman. And then I would do that for a long time, and then I would just kind of just get sick of it. I would cut my hair all short. I would wear masculine clothing, and I would feel so much better in those clothing. But then I would always get perceived to be a lesbian. Which would not have been a problem if I was actually a lesbian. But it was very frustrating for me to... I could never signal what I wanted people to read from me and what I wanted to feel like at the same time. I had to choose, like, do I try to please other people or do I try to please myself?
I like fashion because I think people think they have fashion sense, right? Everyone in this room has some that, you know, you chose what you wore today. Just want to let that sink in for a second. You chose it, right? And like everybody thinks that they have fashion sense, that they have taste. But what, I don't think we really do have taste. We have other people's taste.
Is dressing important?
I think dressing obviously has a bigger purpose. So whatever it is that we dress ourselves in, the purpose of doing that is to signal something about ourselves. So if we have a particular kind of feminine-coded dress and a very masculine-coded dress, then conforming to those standards will then signal to everybody that this is who I am. Most people do it quite unconsciously. It's a mistake to get into this this idea that putting on a dress makes a person a woman or putting on trousers makes a person a man, because obviously there is so much more to it. But at the same time, the process of fitting in to a particular group is really, really important, and that's why, you know, trans people will often talk amongst themselves very much about how to dress and what to wear and how to wear it. And then our critics will be like, it's not about the clothes, it's about your whole being. And we're like, we know, but we have to do this because we have to feel safe, or we have to feel like we fit in. We're searching for that feeling of where we belong. And the clothing is just a massive part of establishing that. And also, it's really tricky. Like, I also remember when I was pre all the medical stuff, I wore a certain kind of masculine clothing. And it was very dandy, and it was fun, and it was very kind of, you know, formal. And it looked a bit like, you know, Annie Lennox or... Tilda Swinton wearing some, like, those are my style icons. I love that stuff. Very old-fashioned. And then as soon as I started taking testosterone, I realized that I no longer looked like a woman who wanted to signal androgyny. I now looked like I was, like, trying too hard. So I had to kind of reinvent my style, my masculine style, and it turned into one that was really, really, really conservative. Right in the middle of what is considered masculine. Like, right in the center, so that I wouldn't draw attention to myself. For the first couple of years of my transition, it was the most important thing for me to signal was male or masculine. And now the most important thing for me to signal is artist. And that feels nice that I no longer have to, I don't have to work quite so hard on signaling my gender. I can signal what kind of man I am. And that's nice to get there.
What about the transition process? When did you decide to go for it?
Somewhere between the ages of 32 and 35, I was warming up to the idea a lot. And it wasn't a sudden thing at all, but I can't really say that there was a specific moment that I decided. I remember there were little things like, for instance, for a long time I thought, no, I can't do it because I don't want to lose my hair. I don't want to be a bald guy. And then at some point I thought, oh, like, men have to deal with that. It's something that you have to deal with. It might happen to you, it might not. Just get over it. And then that was one obstacle. And another one was that I really didn't want to tell... I didn't want to tell my family because I didn't want to disappoint them in any way. And I think I at some point I just figured out that what I, you know, by not wanting to tell them, I don't know what I was waiting for exactly. And at some point I thought, like, am I waiting for my family to be gone eventually, so I don't have to disappoint them like this? And then I thought, I can't wait that long. That's no good. And also, that's not living my life, actually. I have to take responsibility for my own existence. And I have to do what it is I have to do. And if they don't like it, then I will work on that. But that's not going to stop me. The fear of them not... agreeing with it or being disappointed in me is not going to stop it now.
How did your parents react when you told them?
Not badly. I would say that my, you know, some of my family were kind of worried about what might happen to me, what kind of situations I might get in, like, what would I be safe? And my mom took a while to get behind it in a way that she was just, are you sure you have to do this, or is there another way, or very usual parental things. I was really, really afraid of coming out to my dad, my stepmom. And then when I had all this adrenaline kind of built up, I was ready to, like, you know, I didn't know if I was going to have to, like, run away or whatever. I mean, I was just scared because it's a scary, scary moment. And when I said it, then my stepmom was like, oh, you too. And I was like, what's going on? And they had a friend of the family who had a trans son, and who had transitioned between, like, the ages of, like, 18 and 23. And so it was a close family friend, and they saw this process with their friend's kid, and they saw how the young guy just kind of became happier. And they also could see the process that the parents had gone through, you know, to understand it. So they had already been through it, like, once, sort of in a parallel way. They had seen it really kind of up close. And it was so easy for me because of that. It was the weirdest coming out I could have imagined, because they already knew so much that I did not expect them to know. But I was very, very grateful to that kid for existing, so it made my job that much easier. And I think in that sense also, that became part of my decision to still do comedy when I transitioned, because I thought, if I can... I mean, on one hand, I thought, it's a really private process. Maybe I can just keep it to myself. Like, maybe not everybody has to see it. But on the other hand, I thought, if I can make it any bit easier for anybody else, then that is worth it, and I should do it. I think parents also go through a kind of grieving process with it sometimes, where they may have not realized it, but they have had images in their head and ideas in their head about what will happen to this kid. You know, you're going to walk them down the aisle at their wedding, or they will have this kind of life or that kind of life. And then all of a sudden, your kid takes those images and tosses them in the garbage and says that, yeah, that's not going to happen. And I think it leaves parents with a kind of a sense of mourning that they've lost something that they never had, actually, but they've lost something that they had kind of emotionally invested in. If other people are talking about coming out to their parents, I often say, like, you know, give them a year, give them a year and a half to kind of get their emotions behind it, because it might be faster, it might be longer, but I find a lot of parents do seem to come around eventually when they see that it's not really bad. Like, and their kid hasn't actually changed as a person very much at all. They're just kind of more themselves usually.
I went to the general doctor in Finland, and I was like, doctor, I think I'm transgender and I want to transition. And the doctor was nice. And then he sends me to a gynecologist, which is what every new man needs in his life. And then they send you to the gender clinic, which is great, because you sit down for 2 years and they ask you things like, how's your gender? And you're like, it's still here. I love, they ask you questions like, you know, what did you think of your gender when you were 7 years old? And I was like, I wanted to be a dinosaur.
What did you have to do to transition?
It changes a lot from person to person, and it's all, the process is actually changing a lot because there are international standards on how to treat trans people, and there are also individual doctors with different sort of best practices, and so it ends up being a little bit different for everybody. First, I approached a general doctor, and he didn't quite know what to do, so he referred me to a gynecologist, which I didn't think was the right path, but I just went along with it because I thought, okay, I don't know what's going on, so I'll just go with this. And I explained the situation to the gynecologist, who like examined me anyway, and then also gave me a referral to the clinic, the gender clinic, sukupuoli-identiteettitutkimuspoliklinika. So I got a referral there, and about 6 months later, I had my first appointment. And there were two people, there was a nurse and a psychologist in the room. They asked me all kinds of, they just asked me everything, how I grew up, what I was trying to get out of the process, what I was hoping to get, what I would be afraid of, what do I know about the process, what do I know about what will happen to my body, am I completely informed about everything? And then so I had. Then I would have a few more interviews on and off every 3 months or so with a nurse or with a psychologist, and filling out these big checklists about that measure other kinds of mental illness or mental conditions. But they're very strange questions sometimes, like, you know, if have you ever stolen a car, or do you hear voices telling you to do things? And it's very odd because it has nothing to do with gender. After about 8 months, I got a piece of paper that said I could go to the Maestrati and change my name, which I did in December of 2014. And I also got a prescription for testosterone. And that period, starting testosterone and having the new official name, lasted 1 year. And I was still doing the interviews that time. And at the end of that year, I could then go again, like to the police and get a new passport, get a new social insurance number, all of these things. And then in Finland, of course, the other requirement before you change from M to F or F to M is that you are sterile. And in Finland, they haven't required that you undergo surgery to make you sterile. So, for instance, I still have my ovaries, and they're all there. They're fine at the moment. But they've written into the care here that if you're on hormone replacement therapy for 1 year, you are effectively sterile. I got a letter in the mail that said that I am hedelmätön, that I'm infertile. And that was very, very strange, because I could then take that letter to as proof that I could then change my gender after that. So that was very, very, very weird. And of course, that's part of the translaki right now. That is one of the parts that we would like to get out of the trans process right now, because it is a human rights violation. It's basically a throwback to eugenics.
I met my partner when I was in the beginning of transition, and it's really, really common that relationships do not survive transition, one partner transitioning, because the other person, like, the way your pheromones smell, the way you carry yourself, the way that your role is, you do change. As a person, not like fundamentally who you are, but a lot of things about you kind of change. And so it's not uncommon for, you know, the attraction to not survive one person transitioning.
What happens in your body during transition?
Quite a lot of stuff, but for a person assigned female at birth, they'll lose their periods after a while. Hair begins to grow in typically masculine pattern. Your muscle mass will increase, and over time, your bone mass will also increase. Voice lowers. What else? Some people can get acne, just like in puberty. The voice will do the cracking thing in the middle of the process. There are mood changes for many people, and some people there are, I wouldn't say exactly personality changes, but there are, I think anybody who has ever gone through PMS knows that hormones can affect your behavior. It's really hard for me to tell what was the hormone and what was me trying to fit in with masculinity, but I noticed that I got a lot more outgoing. I was more willing to put myself in situations, so I was a bit more aggressive, and not in a kind of like a negative sort of I will do this thing to this person kind of thing, but aggressive in a sense of I was more willing to put myself into a situation. Or to speak up, or to be somewhere. I noticed it was hugely easier in the gym. About 6 months after I started taking testosterone, I was in the gym and I was on a treadmill, and I felt like a cheetah. Like, I just felt like I could choose how long I wanted to run. I could just run forever if I wanted to. And, you know, the first year, a lot of these changes feel like amazing. And so they're kind of like, it's like, oh, this is permanently me. And then after a few years, you get used to it. So it's not quite so, I don't feel like a cheetah anymore. For a lot of trans guys, they notice that their sex drive goes way up for a little while, at least maybe 6 months, maybe a year, maybe 2 years. Actually, even the shape of our genitals will change a little bit, or a lot, depending on the person. Nothing permanent really happens in the first 6 months, which is a good thing. I think that means if people are nervous about trying hormone replacement and they're not sure if it's right for them, because nobody can be sure until they try it, then that means that, you know, you can try it for a few months. You can see, like, does it actually make you feel better? Does it actually give you something that you really did want? And if it doesn't, then you can stop, and there's basically no harm done at all.
And I noticed, like, for instance, when I first started taking testosterone, I shit you not, the very 3 days after I got, like, my first dose of testosterone, I bought power tools and I put up a shelf.
Does your sexuality and being transgender go together?
I thought for a long time as well that you couldn't be gay and trans. Like, you couldn't, if I was a trans man, I couldn't be into men. Like, that was one of the things that made me think I'm not trans, because I am into men. And if I were a trans man, then I would have to be into women. So I would, like, have to be a lesbian first and then a trans man. That's how we thought you got trans people, is you just got somebody who was so gay that they went over to the other side. And it was very silly that we had that idea. Who you are attracted to is not exactly the same as how you wish to be known and how you see yourself.
Being trans has been seen as a mental illness. What do you think about that?
It was just this year that the World Health Organization declared that being transgender is no longer a mental illness. This idea that you look in the mirror and you see something that isn't there, or like that you imagine yourself to be something that you really aren't, is a kind of delusion, is a mental illness thing. But to me, it makes much, much, much more sense to see it as a fairly believable variation on human existence. Like, there's something like, there's like 7 billion people on the planet, and we have a mostly sexually dimorphic species. So by that I mean that most people in the population will be either one or another in terms of their sex. They will be female or they will be male. And that will be determined by chromosomes, but also by the way that development happens in the womb. And there are so many, and hormones and other other factors. And when you have 7 billion individuals, and they can turn out as one thing or another thing, but you have all these different factors that contribute to making those things. Like, if you have all these different ingredients in the recipe, if one of the ingredients just has a variation slightly, then the whole thing can turn out differently. So it may, like, biologically, it makes no sense to think that we wouldn't have a rather large population of people who are a mix of the typically masculine and typically feminine. It just, to me, just, you know, studying biological populations, it's completely known within the biological world that there are variations and that they always happen. If they really want to, they can take a look at that variation and say, oh, that's nature making a mistake. And, I mean, you can think that if you want, but it doesn't change that somebody like me is alive and I'm going to live out my life and I have as much right to the same quality of life as anybody else. And if you're being a little bit more, you know, generous, you can see it as a natural variation on the species, and it's something that enriches us, and it's something that also allows us certain experiences and insights as a society that we would not have without it. Of course, people are very much looking into the science of what makes a person transgender, and Nobody's got the answer yet.
I went through a breakup recently. Thank you. So I went through a breakup recently, and a lot of my comedian friends were like, well, yeah, but, you know, Jamie, you're going to get a lot new material. I was like, would you rather have somebody to hold you at night or a lot of new jokes? And the thing is, if you ask a room full of comedians that question, you're going to split the room, like, right down the middle. Some of them are going to be like, new jokes, no problem. Yeah, I haven't had a new joke in 6 years. I don't know what to do.
Where does all your humor come from?
I think it's just a human capacity to play. I think everybody is funny, and some people just have more practice with letting it out. And performing comedy is a totally different skill. Like, you can be funny and not able to perform it. That's one thing. And I think that's kind of how it is for everybody. I think your sense of humor is really shaped by your family and by your influences when you're younger. And I think that's kind of just where it comes from. Mm. And then either, I don't know, maybe it's just that I never learned to tone it down or to be quiet about it, but I've always just let it out. And also, I mean, I specifically remember when I was a teenager, I really hated the way I looked. My other friends were pretty, and they were skinny, and they were able to get boyfriends for that reason, and that was my thinking. And in my head, that I didn't have, like, I would never be, like, girly enough to get a boyfriend or to make people like me in that way. I couldn't just use my feminine charm. So being funny was my next best option. So I kind of developed this cleverness and this sense of humor in so that I could be noticed.
Could you tell me about Feminist Comedy Night?
I was given a challenge by Leena Kela, who's a performance artist, and she said, you're doing comedy, we'd like to have something at Madhouse in Helsinki, this performance art venue, and we'd like to have something that is like feminist comedy. And I thought, okay, I don't know how to do that, but let's try to do that. So I made a feminist comedy night and tried to get feminist people on the bill and to try to say that this is going to be the focus of the evening. And the first one, I mean, it sold out so quickly and it went really, really well. For me, doing that night is kind of rewarding and amazing in one way, because I'm quite aware of how that night has influenced the scene at large and has created a space where now there you don't have to do this kind of like rough boys club banter stuff to get into comedy. On the other hand, I myself am quite like, I find it so difficult to do comedy with an ideology behind it, because I have such a trickster in me, and I want to make fun of everything. So there should also be a challenge in comedy. It should also be kind of, it should make you think. We should be able to make fun of ourselves. I'm very able to laugh at myself. I can rail against like the Sipilä government or whoever, or Trump. But this is also, I mean, this is very obvious. And also the people in power are not the only people who deserve criticism. Like, for instance, like just because I'm a trans person does not mean I'm a good person. And I don't like that kind of thing, that certain people are untouchable because of their identity. That's completely not true. You can be in a vulnerable position in society, and act terribly. You can be a bad person and need criticism. So I do like to, you know, have my eye on that as well.
The worst thing I ever noticed myself doing, policing masculinity for myself, was actually during sex, because I was having a very good time with my boyfriend at the time, and everything was going really well, and in fact, at some point, I was having a fantastic orgasm, and you know, when you have an orgasm, you sometimes make noises, like sex noises, and so I noticed that my sex noises were kind of, and my back of my head went like, are those too girly? And so I'd be like in the middle of things going, my boyfriend is like, are you okay? I'm like, fine. That was great.
Have you ever dreamt of a family of your own and children?
Yeah, I mean, the fact that I don't have my own kids is more just like it's a matter of circumstance. I never made a decision that I wouldn't have kids or anything like that. I always wanted kids. That was actually a really annoying and difficult part of going through the process, because I knew that going through the process would really... if not make it impossible for me to have my own kids, it would make it really difficult. And technically, at the moment, it's not impossible. It's just, it would require a few steps and a little bit of, like, a lot of planning. And so I kept thinking, like, you know, the two things that you want to do right now, one is that you want to have kids, and the other one is that you want to transition, but have kids first, because that's the way to go around it. And I did that for like a few years until I realized I still don't have this. I'm solving this the wrong way around, even though I know that this is the technically the logical order of things is the wrong way for me. I need to solve this thing first. So I had to transition before I could start to look for the people that I would want to have a family with, for instance. But then again, also, like, I remember when I was, like, 11 or 12, I would think that, you know, I definitely had to have kids, and they had to be my own kids. And I would already imagine, like, you know, what they would do. They would play violin from the age of 3, and they would be world explorers and stuff like that. They would go with me on safari. We'd be taking photographs for National Geographic together. They would be twice as genius as me. And that was kind of how I imagined it. It was like basically an extension of myself that wouldn't die. On one hand, you know, being older, I'm 41, and not having kids that, you know, come from me, on one hand, I find that, you know, kind of sad, because I miss out on these people. Who are they? And on the other hand, I look around at all the other kids and go like, well, they're completely as interesting and amazing as any of my kids would have ever been. And also this idea that it has to be your own, the product of your own body, of your own genes going forward. It starts to look a little bit more selfish to me. Like,
what about adoption?
Yeah, if the kid was smart enough. No, I'm joking. I wouldn't adopt anybody now because I don't have a partner. So it's like, no, I just wouldn't do that. It just, that makes no sense. But it's a really different way of existing, though. I'm interested to see what will happen, you know, by the time, you know, in 30 years, I'll be 70. What will have happened to our bodies? You know, what will this generation have grown up to be like? What will the next generation be holding on to? Like, what's their thing that's going to be happening as well? Will we even have a planet, etc.? You know, climate change is a much more pressing matter for everybody. Actually, even, you know, if you're gonna rank them in a hierarchy, then climate change is probably way more important than anybody's gender or even, you know, income inequality and class and wealth. Like, the the urgency of having a planet at all is obviously, you know, we can't even have inequality without a planet, so we need that for everything. And it's astonishing, but how we'll just, you know, we're just going to let it go. Because we're like that. We're not going to fix it until it's too late. We would rather have 2/3 of us die off in horrible, disastrous ways than fix it now. Because that's who we are. We're nowhere near as good as we say we are.
You have listened to James McDonald in a part of the pod series, Rainbow People. I'm Camilla Telestam, sound designer Nico Ingman, producer Staffan von Martens.